What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favourite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
And good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Eggie Dubol, and our show comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Coming up on the show, well, hundreds of police vehicles donated to help respond to emergencies in the Solomon Islands, but where are they?
I relayed the incident, but what she told me came as a shock. She said, sorry, we don't have any vehicles to assist.
And Australia's ramping up its support for the Pacific and the fight against HIV. And PNG, get ready to support your rugby league players featured in the London Broncos team, thanks to its new owner, Brisbane Broncos icon Darren Lockyer.
A lot of people in Papua New Guinea want to watch them play, so we're in the process at the moment just trying to ensure that we can get these games streamed and then get them coming back into PNG so that they can watch their journey.
All of that and more shortly. But as always, whakawe lahi. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, in Solomon Islands, there's calls for answers over how hundreds of police vehicles, including those donated by Australia, are being used. Frustrated residents in the capital Honiara say they've been left hanging with no response to their emergency calls. As the ABC's Krishna Rita Aman Leong in Honiara reports, it comes as Australia tries to build up its security ties with the Solomons.
When Abraham Ilala's home in Honiara was broken into, his immediate reaction was to call 999. That's the police emergency number.
I called once, twice, no one picked up.
At the third attempt, a police officer picked up.
I relayed the incident, but what she told me came as a shock. She said, sorry, we don't have any vehicles to assist.
Stories like this are familiar across the country. One Honiara magistrate even complained about the excuses made by police over vehicle shortages. It prompted anti-corruption group Transparency Solomon Islands to look deeper into the issue.
The public needs to know, why is their police force not able to respond to their needs when they have been given all of these vehicles? Yeah?
That's Ruth Lilokula, Transparency Solomon Islands CEO.
Resources that they have been given, yeah? But the other question is, when the development partners give us vehicle, what is the government's support to them? How much fuel are they giving the police? And then the other thing is, what is allocated to what?
The police force has received vehicle and equipment donations from the governments of Australia and China since 2022. Public records show over 100 police vehicles were donated in the last 3 years alone. On the streets of the capital Honiara, there are questions on whether the donations are helping law enforcement.
Nothing has really changed.
It feels the same.
Me looking for something change.
Yes, but only small changes, not really noticeable.
No big number.
It is unclear how many police vehicles are currently in use across the country and whether there is still a shortage of vehicles. The ABC put questions to the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force, and this was their response.
The Commissioner has decided not to respond to your request, seeing the security nature of the vehicle allocations.
This response comes in the same week as the arrest of a police officer for allegedly drink driving in a police vehicle. There's also a social media outcry over a photo of people drinking in a police vehicle. And all of this comes as Australia tries to cement its position as the number one security partner by backing a plan to increase the size of the police force. Transparency's Ruth Lilokula says the response by the RSIPF is strange.
It is a security matter for them, but it is also a security and safety matter for the citizens too. So whose security are they talking about? The security of the officers, the security of the vehicles, or the security of what?
Back in Honiara, Abraham Ilala says he wants a police force that can not only restore public confidence, but also turn up.
Just me like a police guard, I'm stuck a truck more for.
I only want police stations to have the vehicles readily available to attend any urgent call-outs.
You may ring police, police must come now.
And that is Abraham Ilala, a Solomon Islands resident, ending that report by the ABC's reporter in Honiara, Krishnarita Almanuleong. Well, Brisbane Broncos icon Darren Lockyer has taken a page out of Hollywood's playbook by buying a second-tier British rugby league club, and he's taking Papua New Guinea along for the ride. Lockyer has become the new owner of the London Broncos and is aiming to haul the club back into the top flight English Super League. It's a feat reminiscent of Ryan Reynolds' fairy tale promotion run with the Welsh football club Wrexham FC. To spark the turnaround, Lockyer has recruited several Papua New Guinean internationals, hoping they can lift the Broncos out of obscurity. Carl Evans has the story.
The London Broncos might be the only rugby league club in Britain to have experienced relegation before a season even began.
Of rugby league's capital club, London Broncos are booking their way back into Super League.
They just won the second-tier English Championship, effectively punching their ticket back to the top-flight English Super League. Unfortunately, it came with some bittersweet news.
We had a part-time squad, but we beat them in the grand final. Massive shock to get promoted into Super League for 2024.
Gavin Willissey is a London sports writer and long-suffering London Broncos fan.
At that exact time that they got promoted, Rugby League in Britain brought in this IMG ranking. So every club was graded a certain number of points for all the things they did on and off the field. And it basically meant that the London Broncos were going to get relegated out of Super League before they even started. So
it was another setback for the club, which had seen multiple demotions, severed ownerships, player exits and financial shortfalls over the past two decades.
There were a handful of good seasons when they were a competitive Super League side, got into playoffs, and then every 4 or 5 years, they basically go bankrupt and all the best players left. And there was a dreadful years of struggle and then relegation from Super League.
But for the first time in what feels like forever, Gavin is optimistic about the club's future. Brisbane Broncos icon Darren Lockyer and his business partner Grant Weschel purchased a 90% stake in the club in September. Lockyer says he aims to haul the capital out of the second-tier championship competition and back to the Super League in an ambitious plan straight out of a Hollywood playbook.
There's been a few examples happen around the world in other sports with where, you know, new ownership with some profile that sort of helps a little bit with the traction in getting people interested in the club. There's examples of it happening, and the third one, which I think was the most exciting, it was like it's London. You know, London's a great city.
You know, you mentioned some of those examples, and the case study that comes to mind is Welcome to Wrexham. Was that a bit of inspiration for this project?
I think it is, yeah. Look, it's a similar concept, but we obviously don't have the same gravitas as those guys. But it's the concept's similar, right?
Lockyer doesn't have the same global reach as the actors, but his purchase comes with an advantage that Wrexham didn't have, a ready-built 9,300-seat stadium in the heart of Wimbledon. His connections have also allowed him to hire Jason Demetrio, coach of Papua New Guinea's national men's team, the Kumuls, who in turn has lured several PNG players to London to help lift the Broncos out of obscurity.
And so he's got to know these guys, and he's worked in Super League before as a player and as a coach, so he knows what's required, and he's really excited for what they can do.
Of the PNG players signed, virtually all were on the PNG Hunters list last year in the Queensland Cup. If they can succeed in London, promotion to the Super League would make an ideal stepping stone for PNG's new NRL franchise, the Chiefs. It allows Lockyer, meanwhile, to tap into a new audience of viewers in PNG's rugby league mad market, a luxury no owner before him has had access to.
A lot of people in Papua New Guinea want to watch them play, so we're in the process at the moment just trying to ensure that we can get these games streamed and then get them coming back into PNG so that they can watch their journey.
However, success is not guaranteed. The high-profile nature of Lockyer's purchase is likely to put the Broncos in the crosshairs of opposition clubs. And even if they win the premiership, the new Super League grading system dictates that commercial standards must also be met to be granted promotion. But Demetrio insists his players are up to the task.
They couldn't have said yes quick enough. They all jumped at the opportunity to come over to London and to test themselves. And it's very different from where they're from. But as I've said to them before, our home will always be there.
History may also be on their side. According to rugby league journalist and historian Patrick Skeen, the UK has long been a place for PNG players to thrive.
The English have a much higher respect for PNG players. There's been 50 PNG players that have played across France and England divisions 1 and 2 since Philip Reldo in 1983 first went over there. Particularly an outpost like Hull, I've had at times 3 or 4 PNG players there.
Broncos superfan Gavin is also hopeful. After watching fan attendance dwindle to less than 500 people in recent years, he's hopeful Lockyer's gamble will pay off.
There is an enthusiasm. It's, you know, anyone who cared about them is interested again now.
And that's London-based sports writer and London Broncos superfan Gavin Willisey ending that report from Carl Evans.
Join Natasha Metin for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
When it comes to obesity prevention efforts, it's really important that it is a combination of diet, exercise, and intense counseling that comes with it.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Not yet, Māori. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, if you were tuning in yesterday on our program, we heard about how AI will be used in Solomon Islands for weather forecasting and disaster preparedness. Well, this morning, we're going to space because in Timor-Leste, a not-for-profit technology group has built the nation's first satellite. The group similarly worked with former NASA scientists and international partners to assemble and put together a cube satellite in-country. The ABC's Timor reporter, Vonya Vieira, asked Ana Paula Xavier, the CEO of Simile, about the ambitions for the satellite.
To work with the international science community, international partner, to develop or create and launch a CubeSat into the space. Yeah.
Can you tell us about the technology being used for the satellite?
So Simile established in Timor-Leste in 2016. At the moment, we are developing an early warning system for the country, so not just the software, but also the hardware. So currently, we have deployed around 50 monitoring stations around the country, and these monitoring stations are able to collect data like precipitation, temperature, radiation, soil moisture, and then from the data, then we'll be able to set up sort of like a threshold. And based on the threshold, the data is analyzed. And based on the threshold, then it's sending out alerts back to the government in order to take action to evacuate people or communities from the risk areas or to sort of like giving the information, the right information to the communities. So that's what we've been doing. And with the satellite, obviously the images that we got from the satellite will be able to help us to do the prediction for the flood or a detection for the flood.
Okay, so why is launching an orbital satellite significant for Timor-Leste at this time?
I guess, we've been in independence for 25 years. Based on the discussion, mostly Timorese, if you're looking at our education, most kids, they study social sciences, they're doing politics, they're doing some engineering, medicine studies. But then there is not a lot of, kids that consider careers in STEM, in science, technology, mathematics, and engineering. and this beginning for you know to get people to be interested in the STEM in Korea, especially with the space technology, that this kind of you know technology or this kind of you know field of study is possible for you know for Timorese kids, and especially those that have you know who have a dream to become a scientist, to become a technologist.
So what partnerships have been like established to support the mission both locally and internationally?
We have been talking to quite a lot of partners, and at the moment we are partnering with you know Capricorn International and Space Base Co. Space Base Co. is a company that established by NASA scientists, and they know you know what to do, and some of our engineers are already you know doing some sort of mentorship or training with them, and then at the moment Simile is actually already a member of GSEN. It's a sort of like a space organization. So, and then you know we will be and also with one of the we also collaborate with one of the Japanese NGOs that you know working in the providing training and for the space. Yeah.
Okay. So, how has the government engaged with the educational institution?
Yeah, so we had a discussion with the Minister of Education. So basically, since one of the most important objectives of this project is for education, and the Minister of Education will announce the naming contest for the kids. So you know to really inspire the you know the young kids, especially those that are still studying. For this project, we will need around $300,000 to $400,000. It's not much for big companies, but for you know, company like ours, that's something that we need to be able to raise in order to start creating of the satellite.
So, who is behind funding or support this project?
At the moment, we are targeting obviously the government, you know, some of the energy companies, UN agencies, some of the embassies that probably will have interest or common interest.
How will we provide Earth data application for national challenge, or like what national challenge for on that?
Look, you know, before 2020, I think before COVID, you know, Timor-Leste has no data at all. And then when we were hit by that big floods in 2021 in April, you know, we had, you know, the country was in chaos, basically. And, you know, the our project of developing early warning system actually came, you know, as a result of that. So at the moment, you know, as I said earlier, that we have deployed around 50 monitoring stations around the country. But those are the real time, and then I think with the data, the Earth data that we got from the satellite, we'll be able to complement some of the work that already been done in the country by Simile and other stakeholders like DNMG, like you know APC. But then you know if you're looking at the application of the data that we will be able to get, it's not only for the you know for the DRR sector or for the disaster risk reduction sector. It can be also used for the you know agriculture sector. It can be used for, you know, government has been, you know, quite like keen on investing on the blue economy, you know.
So this be priority for a country like a Timor, the struggle with the delivery of essential services.
So the data that we will you know we will be able to generate from the satellite, you know, it can be used for so many applications. It's really depending on what the country needs. So yeah.
What can the local community get involved in supporting or learning about this mission?
I guess the local communities, you know, the data that we collected, you know, that will help them, you know, with their not just providing the early warning, but then also if they're doing, you know, if they are farmers, then the data will be able to help them for the irrigation, for the crop health, you know, all these things.
And that was Anna Pollock Xavier, the CEO of Simile. As we heard, she's hopeful their project will spark interest in science, technology, engineering and maths among young Timorese. Meanwhile, the exact date to launch the satellite into space has yet to be confirmed. Pacific Beat. We head to Fiji now, where its Justice Minister says any plans to toughen the drug laws must abide by the national counter-narcotics strategy and the country's obligations to international conventions. Minister Siriomi Turanga says changes must be in the context of existing laws. In his response to a question on what the government is doing to strengthen penalties, his comment comes as Fiji faces a methamphetamine crisis, with health authorities warning of a surge in HIV infections from intravenous drug use. Minister Turanga says provisions are already in place to deal with drug crime.
Any proposed changes, Mr. Speaker, sir, to the penalties for drug offence must align with the National Counter-Narcotics Strategy of 2023-28 and be grounded in robust and coherent legal framework. They must also take into account Fiji's obligations under the international conventions we have ratified, as well as the financial and operational implications for law enforcement agencies, the judiciary, the correctional services. Above all, such reform must be crafted with traditional political and legal mandate for our people, ensuring that they reflect both our national values and our constitutional responsibilities. The current sentencing guideline may apply across all acts identified under Section 4 and 5 of the Illicit Drugs Control Act 2004, subject to the relevant provisions of law, considering the mitigating factors, the aggravating factors, and the sentencing discretion in each individual case.
And that's Fiji's Justice Minister and Acting Attorney General, Siriomi Turanga, speaking in Parliament.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, the Australian government says it will plough almost $50 million into a new program to try and push down the number of HIV infections in the Pacific. The government says the disease is putting pressure on Pacific health systems and societies and comes in the wake of aid cuts from the US and other donors. Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Gidgets joins us now. Stephen, good morning.
Good morning, Aggie.
Look, how concerning is the picture for the Pacific when it comes to HIV?
Look, pretty concerning at the moment. We don't have an absolutely clear picture of what it is like in every single country, but we know that in particular in Fiji and in PNG in particular, there's evidence that the number of cases has really risen and risen quite sharply as well. So, for example, in PNG, you know, there was a report not long ago revealing that there's been a doubling of new infections since 2010. That's approximately, you know, 11,000 cases, for example, last year alone in Fiji. According to advocacy groups, new HIV cases have increased 500% in Fiji since 2023, with the country officially, of course, you might remember, declaring the outbreak or an outbreak in January this year. And their guess is that there'll be over 3,000 new transmissions expected, you know, this year alone. So the picture is a worrying one. And on top of that, experts say it seems to be driven by a prevalence of sometimes very risky behaviour that we're seeing, particularly in HIV. For example, you know, companies and others that watch this sort of thing closely say that many Fijians who are living with HIV are totally unaware of their HIV status, more than one in three perhaps, and only 24% also are receiving treatment. So it's a very worrying picture. And unsurprisingly, governments across the Pacific, as well as governments like Australia, are worried about it and are trying to work out exactly what can be done to drive these figures down.
Yeah, well, so worried enough that they are wanting to, you know, input at least $50 million into this new program. What do we actually know about this program and how it will work?
Look, we know that this program will be rolled out over about 6 years or so, and that it will be in a number of countries. Exactly which countries will get the bulk of the money isn't yet clear. We know that the most pressing need right at the moment is in countries like Fiji, PNG, and also Solomon Islands. I believe that the government's also doing a rapid assessment right now in a few other countries, including Vanuatu and the Federated States of Micronesia, to try and get a sense of what the need is there. The money's likely to be ploughed into both new and existing programs designed to fight the disease. So that includes things like prevention. You know, that means, for example, funding things like needle and syringe programs and things like condoms to try and prevent the spread. To get rid of what they call vertical transmission, testing to try and get more people a sense of whether they've got the disease or not, as well as treatment, care, and support. So broadly, this is about trying to help both on the detection and prevention side, but also on the treatment side. We know that health systems, including in Fiji, are really struggling to cope with the stresses that the disease places upon it at the moment. And this is designed in part to strengthen those health systems, to find the people and to get the material that's needed to help them try and grapple with this more effectively. But it will be a difficult challenge, in part because it depends not just on helping people who get sick, but also trying to drive changes in behaviour that allow the disease to spread. And that, of course, is always more difficult.
A bit of a challenge, yeah. Okay, well, I know that it comes against the backdrop, you know, of aid cuts from the US and even others across the region. Do you think this is why Australia's stepping up here?
Look, I think that's definitely part of the picture. I think one of the main reasons Australia's stepping up is because, you know, these numbers are really worrying, and Pacific governments have, I imagine, come to Australia and said, look, we need some help here to try and get this under control. But it does also come against the backdrop of broader cuts to the region. Now, US aid cuts, that's the most obvious example. I'm told, for example, that USAID previously financed about 15% of PNG's national HIV response, but now it's just ceased operations in PNG. So that's one gap that has got to be plugged. But we have also seen other developed nations, including European nations / development assistance over the last few years, including to the Pacific, although much of this impact is felt in other places like Southeast Asia. So you do get the sense that at the same time, you've got a situation where this problem is getting worse, and yet other countries or some other countries are stepping away. So I suspect that's why Australia has decided to make this decision to plough additional money, this additional $50 million, into the HIV response. Of course, it doesn't mean this is the only thing that's been done to fight HIV in the region. There are already existing government programs and existing donors which are doing good work there. But the fact that you've got this new fund being stepped up probably points to the fact that this problem is getting worse and governments are trying to do what they can to try and fix it.
Stephen, you said, you know, numbers, the HIV numbers are worrying. So then when we look at the aid that's going to be provided, about that $48-50 million, you know, what's that going to actually get you on the ground?
Look, I think what it will probably get on the ground is, you know, what it will probably deliver are just new programs that are needed. So as I mentioned, I think, you know, some of these programs are already up and running, but I imagine you'll see new programs rolled out on the ground to try and change behaviour and to try and not just let people know what's going on. For example, you know, encouraging people to get tested and then get treated, but also to change, you know, some of the behaviour that we've seen, including people, you know, having unprotected sex, obviously, including with sex workers in the region, and also Bluetoothing, which listeners might have heard about. It's a deep problem, which basically is the practice of, you know, essentially sharing blood that contains injected drugs as a way of getting high, and that of course then transmits the virus as a result. So this is a very, very very dangerous behaviour, and one that obviously is contributing to this surge of HIV cases. Now, I don't know what the details will be exactly, but you'd imagine that at least in the case of Fiji, at least some of this money will go towards trying to stop that very dangerous behaviour.
Yeah, Stephen, can you just reconfirm with us? Because, of course, yes, HIV is facing a resurgence in the Pacific, but which countries are affected and why are we actually seeing it come back?
Yeah, I think, as I said, I think the picture is a little bit unclear in the sense that we don't have absolutely detailed data across all of the Pacific. And in some, for example, smaller Pacific countries, we don't necessarily, I'm not sure if the government has a very detailed picture of exactly what's going on. But the data points that you can see in places like Fiji, like in Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands and in others is deeply worrying. It does show a definite surge in the numbers. And so I think that is, as I say, what's behind this announcement today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much, as always, Stephen, for joining us here on the show.
No problem. Thanks, Aggie.
And that is our foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts, joining us here on Pacific Beat.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursdays at 4 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. Now, Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele says more work needs to be done to identify genuine and responsible foreign investors to help grow the country's economy and create jobs. Mr. Manele was in Brisbane for the Australia Solomon Islands Business Forum, a big part of which has been a call out for more private sector involvement in his country. In recent years, there has been many stories out of the Solomon Islands about unscrupulous foreign businesses operating in areas like forestry and mining, not paying resource duties, damaging the environment and angering local communities. Mr. Manele says more foreign investment is vital for the country's economic future, but relevant authorities need to improve their screening processes and monitoring of those allowed into the country. Here he is speaking with Liam Fox.
As a country, the past 47 years has not been easy. We've been grappling with persistent economic challenges emanating from an economy with a narrow economic base, a country with a narrow economic base, but also coupled with challenges in terms of governance, in terms of global trends, so economic shocks, if you like. But also disasters, whether it's man-made or natural disasters. So going forward, our focus is now on diversifying the economic base, and that is investing in fisheries, for example. So in terms of fisheries, we are working on the Bina Harbour tuna cannery. That's an important project for us. It will be transformational if we're able to get it off the ground. Create about 1,600 jobs on Malaita, Malaita being the most populated province in the country. But we are also looking at diversifying the agriculture sector. Agriculture is the backbone of the Solomon Islands economy. We would like to look into mechanizing the agriculture sector so that we can add value and export in terms of trade. Similar initiatives we'd like to pursue in terms of the tourism sector and, of course, the mining sector. Yes, issues have been raised over the years in terms of the type of investors that we would like to see in the country. Of course, any country would like to have genuine investors to come in and invest. We have the investment board, which comes under the Ministry of Commerce, Industries and Labour, and they're the ones tasked with the consideration of applications from those who wish to invest in Solomon Islands. So I believe there is always room for improvement in terms of how the investment board does its work so that we can properly screen and applications for investment. But also, once they are approved, I think the next part of it is to actually monitor their operations or their activities in the Solomon Islands. So that's an area that we need to improve on.
Having been to Solomon's a few times, it strikes me that tourism is like a really untapped potential. What do you think is the potential of tourism in Solomon's, given you've got, you know, Vanuatu next door, Fiji next door, and tourism's big there and generating a lot of revenue?
Yes, we have a huge tourism potential in the country. Our challenge is to turn that potential into reality. At the moment, it's a very small part of the economy, but we would like to expand the tourism sector. We know that tourism is an industry that is dependent also on improvements in other sectors in terms of infrastructure, airport infrastructure, in terms of connectivity, in terms of communications, even in terms of accommodation. I don't think we have enough accommodation in the country at the moment. So these are the gaps that we need to work on. Building and maintaining provincial airstrips, for example. Building more hotels, not only in Honiara, but also in the provinces, including in the Western Province, which is currently the, if you like, the tourism hub of the country. Connectivity, that is improving with the towers project that is currently under implementation. A good number of parts of the country are now connected. It's a project funded by China. But also this afternoon, we just witnessed the signing of the Adamasia cable, a second submarine cable. Thank you to Australia for funding this second submarine cable. This will have positive impacts, not only on e-commerce, education, e-health, but also on tourism initiatives. So going forward, I'm confident that we will be able to capitalize and utilize the potentials that we have in the tourism sector in the near future, provided that we work to improve air connectivity, accommodation, but also tourism products, I think, is also important. What sort of products do we have that we can offer to tourists coming into the country?
And that there is Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele speaking to Liam Fox. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Yes, it's news wrap time where we head around the region to get the latest headlines. And joining me in the studio is producer Finau Fonua Fefe.
Sorry, but Agi, I'm fine.
Thank I know, you. You're back again. What is this? I appreciate you filling in for our brother Kyle. But yes, we've got a couple of stories to get into. This one's really interesting. China's President Xi Jinping has pledged fresh investment into Donga. What are the details here?
Yes, that's right. China's President Xi Jinping pledged fresh investment into Tonga when he met King Thubo Ono, King Thubo VI, this week in Beijing. But he didn't provide a specific figure. This is according to Reuters and State Chinese News. King Thubo VI is in the country on a state visit. Xi Jinping did say in a statement that his government was looking into cooperation in areas such as infrastructure, construction, education, health, tourism and sports. So I guess hinting at investment in these areas. He also acknowledged the climate crisis, which has been the priority issue that we've heard from governments across the Pacific and all these different forums. It's interesting to point out that the King's visit to Beijing occurred just as general elections in Tonga ended. Tonga is heavily indebted to China's state bank, and they're still paying off construction loans taken out two decades to rebuild Nuku'alofa, which was burnt down in that riot in 2006. World Bank data shows Tonga owes Beijing $112 million.
Oh, only just $112 million. Goodness, I swear. Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Manape is facing heat over his government's foreign policy in regards to the West Papua crisis. What's happening here?
So, according to the Post Courier, Deputy Opposition Leader James Donald called on his government to acknowledge the human rights concerns in West Papua, and that's Indonesia's easternmost territory.
Mr. Donald says over 15,000 refugees from West Papua are in Papua New Guinea. As you know, there's a recent surge of violence there from pro-independence insurgent groups. Mr. Donalds posed these questions to James Marape, and Marape did acknowledge reports of human rights abuses in West Papua,
right,
according to international agencies, but he stopped short of recognizing that these human rights abuses were occurring. But he made his foreign policy clear over the status of West Papua. Here's a snippet of what James Marape's response was in Parliament.
Sovereignty issues is different from human rights issues. Sovereignty is a different matter. It is we respect the full sovereign integrity of the Republic of Indonesia. But when it comes to human rights matters, if I can, through you to the Deputy Speaker, to Deputy Opposition Leader, if I could summarize these four questions in my reply, all in all. There is no element of scaredness to Indonesia. There is no element of control in respect to our foreign policy by Indonesia. We respect the United Nations Charter in respect to defining sovereign territories. Papua New Guinea, as it was at 1975, since we established bilateral relations with Indonesia up till today, has not changed in our foreign policy outlook in respect to sovereign integrity of Indonesia. Mind you, Papua New Guinea ourselves, we have a test of sovereignty running as we speak through the Bougainville issue. So we have the test of sovereignty running through the Bougainville issue. We have no moral legs to talk about other nations' sovereignty.
And Marape over the years has strengthened relations with Jakarta. He's visited Indonesia at least twice and met with their new president, Prabowo, since he took office in Jakarta.
Yes, yeah. Thank you for that, Vino. Now, look, finally, I know that there's ongoing pressure on Samoa's government to lift that ban, you know, on the country's only independent newspaper, the Samoan Observer. Can you tell us more?
Yes, continued pressure, this time from Vienna-based International Press Institute. That's a major media organization that advocates for media freedom.
Yes.
And they said in a statement, calling on Prime Minister Lauli Schmidt to reverse his order last week that banned the Samoa Observer from weekly press conferences, the week before that, and to recommit to principles of free press. They said in the statement that the ban sends a dangerous message about the future of Samoa's free press under his leadership. And advocating the importance of press freedom into holding governments accountable and being transparent about their policies.
Because we still haven't heard as to actually how long that temporary ban is for, right?
Exactly.
We're still waiting, yeah. All right, well, thank you as always, Finel, for bringing us our headlines from around the region. That is your news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Join Jacob McQuire and Michael Chow for Nisha Daily every weekday morning on ABC Radio Australia.
When's Emily getting a show?
Well, she kind of runs this one.
She does run this one.
I don't mind being in the background, guys. I can just roll my eyes and shake my head at all the things you say. I'm happy with that.
But you know how some places have like a swear jar? We need like an eye roll / head shake jar for Emily.
Nisha Daily, weekday mornings from 7 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Kia ora now, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, finding the money to fund cricket in the Pacific is no easy task. So for associate nations like Vanuatu, 2 years of guaranteed income from the International Cricket Council will make life easier in 2026 and 2027. Now that's the good news, but however, the picture for 2028 is not so bright against the background of less intense competition for media rights in India. It's a situation that has promoted the Royal Dutch Cricket Federation to warn of a 30% drop in ICC revenue, which in turn will mean cuts for all members from the top to the bottom. In the Pacific, for the likes of Vanuatu, Samoa and PNG, Vanuatu Cricket's chief executive, Tim Cutler, says those cuts will hurt.
We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars there for those three. And that's a matter of us CEOs having to get out there and really try and find other ways to diversify our funding sources, donations, sponsors, government support. Some of us are lucky to tap into funding like Australia's Team Up, which is linked to our support for development programs. But yeah, that'll mean that there'll have to be some tough conversations. You know, we only hope that we'll have as long as possible to prepare for this. But unfortunately, that's just life in sport.
Clearly, if there were additional sponsors prepared to come on board, that would be one way of finding additional funds. But beyond that, where would you look? The Dutch, for example, are talking about an increase in player contributions, but I'm thinking that wouldn't really work in a country like Vanuatu.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, nobody here pays for any cricket whatsoever, whether it's player fees, team fees. We provide everything free of charge. And I don't think in a place like this, after everything the country's has suffered post-earthquake, etc., that us going out with a handout to keep things going would be anywhere but very much at the bottom of our list of initiatives. As a single country, trying to do better with finding sponsors and donors. It might also be an opportunity to either work together with other sports in a country or even with other countries' cricket associations to find regional sponsors, whether it's regional tournaments, etc. More and more sponsorships these days are more or less linked to programs and initiatives. It's just doing the best you can to find those companies that share the same values as you do as an organization. It's really finding those companies that have that same mindset and doing everything you can of finding every pot of money that there is around, whether it's Australian government, the UN, other governments. You know, we've been really fortunate here in Vanuatu that we're the selected sport for the team support grant that comes out of cricket being back in the Olympics. So we're the nominated sport for there. That's just the life of a sports administrator. So, yeah, it just means more hard work for people like me and others in funding and fundraising positions.
So would it be fair to say that there's a little bit of additional pressure perhaps on your national teams to do as well as they can over the next couple of years to ensure that the slice of the pie that you get post-2028 is as big as it can be?
That's associate cricket for you, really, Richard, that there is always pressure on teams. And frankly, I'm amazed that players are able to be as calm and go out there and play as well as they do, considering the actual weight that's on their shoulders. We've just seen this amazing Ashes test go for 2 days and everybody talk about that. But these players aren't going out there with the weight of their country's cricket program on their shoulders, which hundreds of associate cricketers have. So is there any additional pressure? I don't think so, because I think that is just the world that the cricketers here have grown up in, and knowing that funding is temporary and ephemeral sometimes when it comes to funding that's linked to tournaments. But I think that's the amazing thing about associate cricket that doesn't really get enough airtime. The fact that these cricketers that a lot of time that are balancing work, life and cricket actually have a lot more riding on the games that they're out there playing in than anyone we see out in an Ashes or a big World Cup final. So I think the players will be okay. It's just a matter of, from an organisational point of view, trying to take the pressure off them. And that would be, if I ever looked at legacy for someone in my position, it's having a system in place that means that players are able to go out there and just play, not being worried about whether they'll be able to have bats and balls paid for next season, depending how they go in that one particular game.
It's certainly true that none of the Australian side, for example, have done any fruit picking of late, which of course many of your players have and are still doing. But if we look at the opportunities that they will have as national teams in the next couple of years, the rules seem to change all the time, but there are some big tournaments coming up for the women and the men. The women are right up there at the moment with PNG. The men perhaps have slipped a little, with arguably Samoa the top side in the region at the moment based on recent results. So a little bit of a shift, but plenty of opportunities for both sides.
Yes, and look, it's amazing. Our women remain the country's highest-ranked sporting team. They're 30th in the world. And it was Chris Laffin, a high-performance manager and national coach here, who pointed out that of all the other countries in that top 30, the country with the closest population is Namibia. And they have 9 times the population of our 330,000. So I think sometimes I, and that's a very personal I, but there's also the royal we, need to remind ourselves of just how well our women have done, considering the weight of population behind that. And it's just a testament to how talented they are and the potential, really, that if cricket got to be as popular in Vanuatu as say, football is, of what they could be. But yes, they, by virtue of coming second in the World Cup qualifier in Fiji to PNG, they go into the new ICC Women's T20 Challenge Trophy. And that was the next best teams in each of the regions. So they'll be playing in Rwanda at the beautiful Gahunga Stadium in April, it looks like. And that'll be Rwanda, the hosts, Nepal Italy, Vanuatu, and the USA. They're all ranked in the 20s with us at number 30. So that'll be a great challenge. And our men have a super sub-regional. And the first time that all nine countries in East Asia Pacific will participate in a single event. And that's for the T20 World Cup. And that'll be in Japan in May. Aside from that, our under-19 women's are going to be in the EAP World Cup qualifier for the first time ever. And that will be in PNG in April too. So when we do our budgeting, which is always 12 months, January to December for all ICC members, you're not quite sure about what you're getting funding-wise from the ICC until November, December. But when you've got that many tournaments at the start of the year, it kind of just puts a little added bit of pressure when you're trying to assign money to these events. You're not quite sure whether you're going to get it or not.
And that's Tim Cutler, CEO of Vanuatu Cricket, on the line from Port Vila, and he was talking to Richard Hewitt. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Remember, you can find our stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. But we will be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. And then, as always, you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is up next. And then coming up after that, it is the Voice of Nisha Daily. So until next time, o tua o whātou, this has been Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Okay.